nothing, felt nothing, till dimly as in a dream she saw the Ohio side, and a man helping her up the bank.
"You're a brave gal now, whoever you are," said the man with an oath.
Eliza recognized the voice and face for a man who owned a farm not far from her old home. "Oh, Mr. Sims, save me, do hide me," said Eliza.
"Why, what's this?" said the man. "Why, if it ain't Shelby's gal."
"My child, this boy, he'd sold him. There's his massa," said she, pointing to the Kentucky shore. "Oh, Mr. Sims, you've got a little boy."
"So I have," said the man, as he roughly but kindly drew her up the steep bank. "Besides, you're a right brave gal. I lack grit wherever I see it."
When they had gained the top of the bank, the man paused. "I'd be glad to do something for you," said he, "but then there's nowhere I could take you. The best I can do is tell you to go there," said he, pointing to a large white house which stood by itself off the main street of the village. "Go there. They're kind folks. There's no kind of danger, but they'll help you. They're up to all that sort of thing."
"The Lord bless you," said Eliza earnestly.
"No occasion, no occasion in the world," said the man. "What I've done's of no count."
"And oh, surely, sir, you won't tell anyone."
"Go to thunder, gal. What do you take a fellow for?" "In course not," said the man. "Come, now go along like a likely sensible gal as you are. You've earned your liberty, and you shall have it, for all me."
The woman folded her child to her bosom, and walked firmly and swiftly away. The man stood and looked after her.
"Shelby, now maybe won't think this year the most neighborly thing in the world. But what's a feller to do? If he catches one of my gals in the same fix, he's welcome to pay back. Somehow, I never could see no kind of critter a-strivin' and pantin' and tryin' to clare theirselves with the dogs arter him and go agin him.
Besides, I don't see no kind of occasion for me to be hunter and catcher for other folks neither."
So spoke this poor, heathenish Kentuckian, who had not been instructed in his constitutional relations and consequently was betrayed into acting in a sort of Christianized manner, which, if he had been better situated and more enlightened, he would not have been left to do. Haley had stood a perfectly amazed spectator of the scene, till Eliza had disappeared up the bank, when he turned a blank, inquiring look on Sam and Andy.
"That gal's got 7 devils in her, I believe," said Haley. "How like a wildcat she jumped!"
"Well, now," said Sam, scratching his head, "hope Mass excuse us trying to dat our road. Don't think I feel spry enough for dat ar, no way." And Sam gave a hoarse chuckle.
"You laugh," said the trader, with a growl.
"Lord bless you, Massa, I couldn't help it now," said Sam, giving way to the long-pent-up delight of his soul. "She looked so curious and leaping, springing, ice a-cracking, and only to hear her plump, ker-chunk, ker-splash, spring! Lord knows how she goes it!"
And Sam and Andy laughed till the tears rolled down their cheeks.
"I'll make you laugh to the side of your mouths," said the trader, laying about their heads with his riding-whip.
Both ducked and ran shouting up the bank, and were on their horses before he was up. "Good evening, Massa," said Sam, with much gravity. "I very much expect Missus be anxious about Jerry. Massa Haley won't want us no longer. Missus wouldn't bear of our riding the critters over Lizzie's bridge tonight," and with a facetious poke into Andy's ribs, he started off, followed by the latter, at full speed, their shouts of laughter coming faintly on the wind.
Chapter 8. Eliza's Escape. Eliza made her desperate retreat across the river just in the dusk of twilight. The gray mist of evening, rising slowly from the river, enveloped her as she disappeared up the bank, and the swollen current and floundering masses of ice presented a hopeless barrier between her and her pursuer. Haley, therefore, slowly and discontentedly returned to the little tavern to ponder further what was to be done. The woman opened to him the door of a little parlor, covered with a rag carpet, where stood a table with a very shining black oilcloth, sundry lank, high-backed wood chairs, with some plaster images in resplendent colors on the mantel-shelf. Above a very dimly smoking grate, a long hardwood settle extended its uneasy length by the chimney, and here Haley sat him down to meditate on the instability of human hopes and happiness in general.
"What did I want with the little cuss now?" he said to himself. "That I should have got myself treed like a coon, as I am, this-er way."
And Haley relieved himself by repeating over a not very select litany of imprecations on himself, which, though there was the best possible reason to consider them as true, we shall, as a matter of taste, omit. He was startled by the loud and dissonant voice of a man who was apparently dismounting at the door. He hurried to the window.
"By the land! If this year ain't the nearest now to what I've heard folks call Providence," said Haley, "I do believe that's our Tom Loker."
Haley hastened out. Standing by the bar in the corner of the room was a brawny, muscular man, full 6 feet in height, and broad in proportion. He was dressed in a coat of buffalo skin, made with the hair outward, which gave him a shaggy and fierce appearance, perfectly in keeping with the whole air of his physiognomy. In the head and face every organ and lineament, expressive of brutal and unhesitating violence, was in a state of the highest possible development. Indeed, could our readers fancy a bulldog come unto man's estate, and walking about in a hat and coat, they would have no unapt idea of the general style and effect of his physique. He was accompanied by a traveling companion, in many respects an exact contrast to himself. He was short and slender, lithe and cat-like in his motions, and had a peering, mousing expression about his keen black eyes, with which every feature of his face seemed sharpened into sympathy. His thin, long nose ran out as if it was eager to bore into the nature of things in general. His sleek, thin black hair was stuck eagerly forward, and all his motions and evolutions expressed a dry, cautious acuteness. The great man poured out a big tumbler half full of raw spirits, and gulped it down without a word. The little man stood tiptoe, and putting his head first to one side and then the other, and snuffing considerably in the directions of the various bottles, ordered at last a mint julep, in a thin and quivering voice, and with an air of great circumspection. When poured out, he took it and looked at it with a sharp, complacent air, like a man who thinks he has done about the right thing, and hit the nail on the head and proceeded to dispose of it in short and well-advised sips. "Well now, who'd have thought this year luck's had come to me, why, Loka? How are ye?" said Haley, coming forward and extending his hand to the big man. "The devil," was the civil reply. "What brought you here, Haley?" The mousing man, who bore the name of Marks, instantly stopped his sipping and, poking his head forward, looked shrewdly on the new acquaintance, as a cat sometimes looks at a moving dry leaf, or some other possible object of pursuit. "I say, Tom, this year's the luckiest thing in the world. I'm in a devil of a hobble, and you must help me out."
Oh, like enough," grunted his complacent acquaintance. "A body may be pretty sure of that when you're glad to see him. Something to be made off of him? What's the blow now?"
"You got a friend here?" said Haley, looking doubtfully at Marks. "Partner, perhaps?"
"Yes, I have. Here, Marks. Here's that our fella that I was in with in Natchez."
"Shall be pleased with his acquaintance," said Marks, thrusting out a long, thin hand, like a raven's claw. "Mr. Haley, I believe."
"The same, sir," said Haley. "And now, gentlemen, seeing as we've met so happily, I think I'll stand up to a small matter of a treat in this here parlor. So now, Coon," said he to the man at the bar, "get us hot water and sugar and cigars and plenty of the real stuff, and we'll have a blowout." Behold, then, the candles lighted, the fire stimulated to the burning point in the grate, and our three worthies seated around a table, well spread with all the accessories to good fellowship enumerated before. Haley began a pathetic recital of his peculiar troubles. Loker shut up his mouth and listened to him with gruff and surly attention. Marks, who was anxiously and with much fidgeting compounding a tumbler of punch to his own peculiar taste, occasionally looked up from his employment and, poking his sharp nose and chin almost into Haley's face, gave the most earnest heed to the whole narrative. The conclusion of it appeared to amuse him extremely, for he shook his shoulders and sides in silence and perked up his thin lips with an air of great internal enjoyment. "So then, you fairly showed up, aren't you?" he said. "It's neatly done, too." "This here young'un business makes lots of trouble in the trade," said Haley dolefully. "If we could get a breed of gals that didn't care now for the young'uns," said Marks. "Tell you, I think it would be about the greatest modern improvement I knows on," and Marks patronized his joke by a quiet introductory sniggle.
"Just so," said Haley. "I never couldn't see it into it. Young'uns is heaps of trouble to 'em, one would think now. They'd be glad to get Claire on 'em. They aren't. And the more trouble a young'un is, and the more good for nothing as a gentle thing, the tighter they sticks to 'em."
"Well, Mr. Haley," said Marks, "it's past the hot water."
"Yes, sir, you say, it's what I feel and all us have. Now, I bought a gal once when I was in the trade at tight, likely wench she was, too, quite considerable smart, and she had a young'un that was miserable sickly. It had a crooked back or something or other, and I just gin away to a man that thought he'd take his chance raising on it, being it didn't cost nothing, never thought, you know, of that gal's taking on about it. But, Lord, you oughta see how she went on. Why, really, she did seem to me to vally the child more, 'cause it was sickly and cross and plagued her. And she weren't making believe, neither. Cried about it, she did, and loped around, as if she'd lost every friend she had. It really was droll to think on it, Lord. There ain't no end to woman's notions.
"Well, just so with me," said Haley. "Last summer down on Red River, I got a gal traded off on me, with a likely-looking child enough, and his eyes looked as bright as yourn. Come to look, I found him stone blind. Fact, he was stone blind. Well, you see, I thought there weren't no harm in my just passing him along and not saying nothing, and I'd got him nicely swapped off for a keg of whiskey. Come to get him away from the gal, and she was just like a tiger. So 'twas before we started, and I hadn't got my gang chained up. So what should she do but ups on a cotton bale like a cat, catches a knife from one of the deckhands, and I tell you, she made all fly for a minute, till she saw it won't no use. And she just turns round and pitches head first, young'un and all, into the river, went down plumb, and never riz.
"Bah," said Tom Loker, who had just listened to these stories with ill-repressed disgust. "Shiftless, both of you. My gals don't cut up no such shines, I tell you."
"Indeed, how do you help it?" said Marks briskly.
"Help it? Why, buys a gal, and if she's got a young'un on to be sold, I just walks up and puts my fist to her face and says, 'Look here now, if you give me one word out of your head, I'll smash your face in.' I won't hear one word, not the beginning of a word. I says to him, 'This here young'un's mine, and not yourn, and you've no kind of business with it. I'm going to sell it. First chance, mind, you don't cut up none, or you're shines about it, or I'll make you wish you'd never been born.' I tell you, they sees it ain't no play when I gets hold. I makes them as wist as fishes, and if one of them begins and gives a yelp, why?" And Mr. Loker brought down his fist with a thump that fully explained the hiatus. "That's our what you may call emphasis," said Marks, poking Haley in the side, and going into another small giggle. "Ain't Tom peculiar? He, he. I say, Tom, I expect you make 'em understand, for all niggers' heads is woolly. They don't never have no doubt o' your meanin', Tom. If you ain't the devil, Tom, you's his twin brother. I'll say that for you." Tom received the compliment with beaming modesty, and began to look as affable as was consistent, as John Bunyan says, with his doggish nature. Haley, who had been imbibing very freely of the staple of the evening, began to feel a sensible elevation and enlargement of his moral faculties, a phenomenon not unusual with gentlemen of a serious and reflective turn under similar circumstances. "Well, now, Tom," he said, "you really is too bad. As I always have told you, you know, Tom, you and I used to talk over these year matters down in Natchez, and I used to prove to you that we made full as much, and was as well off for this year world by treatin' on him well, besides keepin' a better chance for comin' in the kingdom at last, when wust comes to wust, and there ain't nothin' else left to get, you know?"
"Pah!" said Tom. "Don't I know? Don't make me too sick with any of your stuff. My stomach is a little riled now," and Tom drank half a glass of raw brandy.
"I say," said Haley, and leaning back in his chair and gesturing impressively, "I'll say this now. I always meant to drive my trade so as to make money on it. 'Tis fust and foremost, as much as any man. But then, trade ain't everything, and money ain't everything, 'cause we's all got souls. I don't care now who hears me say it, and I think I cussed sight on it. So I may as well come out with it. I believe in religion, and one of these days when I've got matters tight and snug, I calculates to tend to my soul, and them our matters. And so what's the use of doing any more wickedness than's really necessary? It don't seem to me it's tall prudent."
"Tend to your year soul," repeated Tom contemptuously. "Take a bright look out to find a soul in you. Save yourself any care on that score. If the devil sifts you through a hair sieve, he won't find one."
"Why, Tom, you're cross," said Haley. "Why can't you take it pleasant now, when a feller's talking for your good?"
"Stop that ar jaw yarn there," said Tom gruffly. "I can stand most any talk of yarn, but your pious talk there kills me right up. After all, what's the odds between me and you? 'Tain't that you care one bit more, I have a bit more feeling. It's clean sheer dog meanness, wanting to cheat that devil and save your own skin. Don't I see through it? And you're getting religion, as you call it, arter all, is too pissin' mean for any critter. Run up a bill with the devil all your life, and then sneak out when pay time comes. Bob!"
"Come, come, gentlemen, I say this isn't business," said Marks. "There's a different ways, you know, of looking at all subjects. Mr. Haley is a very nice man, no doubt, and has his own conscience, and Tom, you have your ways and very good ones, too, Tom. But quarrelling, you know, won't answer no kind of purpose. Let's go to business. Now, Mr. Haley, what is it you want us to undertake to catch this yer gal?"
"The gal's no matter of mine. She's Shelby's. It's only the boy. I was a fool for buying the monkey."
"You're generally a fool," said Tom gruffly.
"Come now, Loker, none of your huffs," said Marks, licking his lips. "You see, Mr. Haley's a-putting us in a way of a good job. I reckon, just hold still, these yer arrangements is my forte. This yer gal, Mr. Haley, how is she? What is she?"
"Well, white and handsome, well brought up. I'd a gin she'll be 800 or 1,000, and then made well on her."
"White and handsome, well brought up," said Marks, his sharp eyes, nose, and mouth all alive with enterprise. "Look here now, Loker, a beautiful opening. We'll do a business here on our own account. We does the catching, the boy, of course, goes to Mr. Haley,
We takes the gal to Orleans to speculate on. Ain't it beautiful?
Tom, whose great heavy mouth had stood ajar during this communication, now suddenly snapped it together, as a big dog closes on a piece of meat, and seemed to be digesting the idea at his leisure.
"You see," said Marks to Haley, stirring his punch as he did so, "you see, we has justices convenient at all pints along shore, that does up any little jobs in our line quite reasonable. Tom, he does the knocking down in the hour, and I come in all dressed up, shining boots, everything first chop, and the swearin's to be done.
You ought to see now," said Marks in a glow of professional pride, "how I can tone it off. One day I'm Mr. Twickum, from New Orleans. Another day I'm just come from my plantation on Pearl River, where I work 700 niggers. Then again, I come out a distant relation of Henry Clay or some old cock in Kentuck. Talents is different, you know. Now Tom's roarer when there's any thumping or fighting to be done, but at lying he ain't good. Tom ain't. You see, it don't come natural to him. But Lord, if there's a feller in the country that can swear to anything and everything, and put in all the circumstances and flourishes with a long face and carry it through better than I can, why, I'd like to see him. That's all. I believe my heart. I could get along and snake through, even if justices were more particular than these. Sometimes I rather wish they was more particular. 'Twould be a heap more relishin' if they was. More fun, you know."
Tom Loker, who, as we have made it appear, was a man of slow thoughts and movements, here interrupted Marks by bringing his heavy fist down on the table so as to make all ring again.
"It'll do," he said. "Lord bless you, Tom. You needn't break all the glasses," said Marks. "Save your fist for time of need."
"Gentlemen, ain't I come in for a share of the profit?" said Haley.
"Ain't it enough we catch the boy for you?" said Loker. "What do you want?"
"Well," said Haley, "if I gives you the job, it's worth something. Say 10% on the profits, expenses paid."
"Now," said Loker, with a tremendous oath and striking the table with his heavy fist, "don't I know you, Dan Haley? Don't you think to come it over me? Suppose Marks and I have taken up the catching trade just to accommodate gentlemen like you and get nothing for ourselves? Not by a long chalk. We'll have the gal out and out, and you keep quiet, or you see we'll have both.
What's to hinder?
Hain't you showed us the game? It's as free to us as you, I hope. If you or Shelby wants to chase us, look where the partridges was last year. If you find them or us, you're quite welcome."
"Oh, well, certainly. Just let it go at that," said Haley, alarmed. "You catch the boy for the job, you allers did trade far with me, Tom, and was up to your word."
"You know that," said Tom. "I don't pretend none of your snivelling ways, and I won't lie in my accounts with the devil himself. What I says I'll do, I will do. You know that, Dan Haley."
"Just so. Just so, I said so, Tom," said Haley. "And if you'd only promise to have that boy for me in a week, at any point you'll name, that's all I want."
"But it ain't all I want by a long jump," said Tom. "You don't think I did business with you down in Natchez for nothing, Haley. I've learned to hold an eel when I catch him. You got to fork over $50, flat down, or this child don't start a peg. I know you're."
"Why, when you have a job in hand that may bring a clean profit of somewhere about $1,000 or $1,600, why, Tom, you're unreasonable," said Haley.
"Yes, and hasn't we business booked for 5 weeks to come? All we can do, and suppose we leaves all and goes to bushwhacking round arter your young'uns, and finally doesn't catch the gal, and gals allers is the devil to catch, what's then? Would you pay us a cent, would you? I think I see you doing it."
"Ugh! No, no, flap down your 50. If we get the job and it pays, I'll hand it back. If we don't, it's for our trouble. That's far, ain't it, Marks?"
"Certainly, certainly," said Marks with a conciliatory tone. "It's only a retaining fee, you see. We lawyers, you know. Well, we must all keep good-natured, keep easy, you know. Tom will have the boy for you, anywhere you'll name. Won't you, Tom?
If I find the young'un, I'll bring him on to Cincinnati and leave him at Granny Belcher's on the landing," said Loker. Marks had got from his pocket a greasy pocket-book, and taking a long paper from thence, he sat down and, fixing his keen black eyes on it, began mumbling over its contents. "Barnes, Shelby County. Boy, Jim. $300 for him, dead or alive. Edwards, Dick and Lucy, man and wife. $600. Wench, Polly, and 2 children, $600 for her, or her head. I'm just a-running over our business to see if we can take up this year handily, Loker," he said, after a pause. "We must set Adams and Springer on the track of these year. They've been booked some time."
"They'll charge too much," said Tom. "I'll manage that hour. They's young in the business and must expect to work cheap," said Marks, as he continued to read. "That's 3 on 'em easy cases, 'cause all you got to do is to shoot 'em, or swear they is shot, and couldn't, of course, charge much for that. Them other cases," he said, folding the paper, "we'll be putting off a spell. So now let's come to the particulars. Now, Mr. Haley, you saw this here gal when she landed?"
"To be sure, plain as I see you."
"And a man helping on her up the bank?" said Loker.
"To be sure I did."
"Most likely," said Marks, "she's took in somewhere, but where's a question?
Tom, what do you say? We must cross the river tonight, no mistake, said Tom.
But there's no boat about, said Marks. The ice is running awfully. Tom, ain't it dangerous?
Dunno about that, only it's got to be done, said Tom, decidedly.
Dear me, said Marks, fidgeting. It'll be, I say, he said. It's dark as a wolf's mouth, and Tom...
The long and short is you're scared, Marks. But I can't help that. You've got to go. Suppose you want to lie by a day or two, till the gal's been carried on the underground line, up to Sandusky or so, before you start?
Oh, no. I ain't a grain afraid, said Marks, only.
Only what? Said Tom. Well, about the boat. You see, there ain't any boat.
I heard the woman say there was one coming along this evening, and that a man was going to cross over in it.
Neck or nothing. We must go with him, said Tom.
I suppose you've got good dogs, said Haley.
First rate, said Marks. But what's the use? You hadn't got nothing of hers to smell on.
Yes, I have, said Haley triumphantly. Here's her shawl she left on the bed in her hurry. She left her bonnet, too.
That's our lucky, said Loka. Fork over. Though the dogs might damage the gal, if they come on her unaware, said Haley.
That's our consideration, said Marks. Our dogs tore a feller half to pieces once down in Mobile, before we could get him off.
Well, you see, for this sort that's to be sold for their looks, that I won't answer, you see, said Haley.
I do see, said Marks. Besides, if she's got took in, tain't no go neither. Dogs is no count in these year upstates where these critters get carried. Of course, you can't get on their track. They only does down in plantations where niggers, when they runs, has to do their own running, and don't get no help.
Well, said Loka, who had just stepped out to the bar to make some inquiries, they say the man's come with the boat, so Marks.
That worthy cast a rueful look at the comfortable quarters he was leaving, but slowly rose to obey.
After exchanging a few words of further arrangement, Haley, with visible reluctance, handed over the $50 to Tom, and the worthy trio separated for the night. If any of our refined and Christian readers object to the society in which this scene introduces them, let us beg them to begin and conquer their prejudices in time. The catching business, we beg to remind them, is rising to the dignity of a lawful and patriotic profession. If all the broad land between the Mississippi and the Pacific becomes one great market for bodies and souls, and human property retains the locomotive tendencies of this 19th century, the trader and catcher may yet be among our aristocracy. While this scene was going on at the tavern, Sam and Andy, in a state of high felicitation, pursued their way home. Sam was in the highest possible feather and expressed his exultation by all sorts of supernatural howls and ejaculations, by divers odd emotions and contortions of his whole system. Sometimes he would sit backward, with his face to the horse's tail and sides, and then with a whoop and a somerset, come right side up in his place again, and drawing on a grave face, began to lecture Andy in high-sounding tones for laughing and playing the fool. Anon, slapping his sides with his arms, he would burst forth in peals of laughter that made the old woods ring as they passed. With all these evolutions, he contrived to keep the horses up to the top of their speed, until between 10 and 11 their heels resounded on the gravel at the end of the balcony. Mrs. Shelby flew to the railings.
"Is that you, Sam? Where are they?"
"Master Haley's a-restin' at the tavern. He's dreadful fatigued, missus."
"And Eliza? Sam?"
"Well, she's clear across Jordan, as a body may say, in land of Canaan."
"Why, Sam, what do you mean?"
said Mrs. Shelby, breathless and almost faint, as the possible meaning of these words came over her. "Well, missus, de Lord, he preserves his own. Lizzie's done gone over the river into how, as markable as if de Lord took her over in a chariot of fire and 2 horses. Sam's vein of piety was always uncommonly fervent in his mistress's presence, and he made great capital of scriptural figures and images.
"Come up here, Sam," said Mr. Shelby, who had followed on to the veranda, "and tell your mistress what she wants. Come, come, Emily," said he, passing his arm round her. "You are cold and all in a shiver, and allow yourself to feel too much."
"Feel too much? Am not I a woman? A mother? Are we not both responsible to God for this poor child? My God, lay not this sin to our charge."
"What sin, Emily? You see yourself that we have only done what we were obliged to do."
"There's an awful feeling of guilt about it, though," said Mrs. Shelby. "I can't reason it away."
"Here, Andy, you nigger be alive," called Sam under the veranda. "Take these here horses to de barn. Don't you hear Massa callin'?"
And Sam soon appeared, palm leaf in hand, at the parlor door.
"Now, Sam, tell us distinctly how the matter was," said Mr. Shelby. "Where's Eliza, if you know?" "Well, Master, I saw her with my own eyes a-crossin' on the floatin' ice. She crossed most markably. It wasn't no less nor a miracle, and I saw a man help her up the high side, and then she was lost in the dusk."
"Sam, I think this rather apocryphal, this miracle. Crossing on floating ice isn't so easily done," said Mr. Shelby.
"Easy? Couldn't nobody have done it, without the Lord. Why now?" said Sam. "'Twas just dis dear way. Master Haley and me and Andy, we comes up to a little tavern by the river, and I rides a little ahead.
I so jealous to be catching Lizzie that I couldn't hold in, no way. And when I comes to the tavern window, sure enough, there she was right in plain sight, and they digging on behind. Well, I loses off my hat and sings out enough to raise the dead. Of course, Liza, she hollers, and she dodges back when Massa Haley, he goes past the door, and then, I tell you, she clared out the side door. She went down to the riverbank. Massa Haley, he seed her and yelled out, and him and me and Andy, we took order. Now she come down to the river, and thar was the current running 10 feet wide by the shore, and over to the other side, ice a-sawin' and a-jigglin' up and down, kinda as towards a great island. We come right behind her, and I thought my soul he'd got her sure enough, when she gin sich a screech as I never hearin', and there she was, clear over to other side of the current on the ice, and then on she went, a-screechin' and a-jumpin', the ice went crack, go up, crackin', chunk, and she a-boundin' like a buck. Lord, the spring that I's got in her ain't common, I'm opinion. Mrs. Shelby sat perfectly silent, pale with excitement, while Sam told his story.
"God be praised, she isn't dead," she said. "But where is the poor child now?"
"The Lord will provide," said Sam, rolling up his eyes piously. "As I've been a-saying, this year's a providence and no mistake, as Mrs. has allers been an-instructing on us. There's allers instruments rise up to do the Lord's will. Now, if it hadn't been for me to-day, she'd been a-took a dozen times. Weren't it I started off the horses this year morning, and kept him chasing to hide dinner-time? And didn't I car Massa Haley night 5 miles out of the road this evening, or else he'd come up with Lizzie as easy as a dog-art or a coon? These are all providences." "They are a kind of providences that you'll have to be pretty sparing of, Master Sam. I allow no such practices with gentlemen on my place," said Mr. Shelby, with as much sternness as he could command under the circumstances. "Now there's no more use in making believe be angry with a negro than with a child. Both instinctively see the true state of the case, through all attempts to effect the contrary, and Sam was in no wise disheartened by this rebuke, though he assumed an air of doleful gravity, and stood with the corners of his mouth lowered, in most penitential style. "Massa quite right, quite. It was ugly on me, there's no disputing that are. And of course Massa and Mrs. wouldn't encourage no such works. I'm sensible of that are, but a poor nigger like me. It's amazing, tempted to act ugly sometimes when fellas will cut up such shines as that or Missa Haley. He ain't no gentleman, no way. Anybody's been raised as I've been can't help seeing that there." "Well, Sam," said Mrs. Shelby, "as you appear to have a proper sense of your errors, you may go now and tell Aunt Chloe she may get you some of that cold ham that was left of dinner today. You and Andy must be hungry." "Mrs. is a heap too good for us," said Sam, making his bow with alacrity and departing. It will be perceived, as has been before intimated, that Master Sam had a native talent that might, undoubtedly, have raised him to eminence in political life. A talent of making capital out of everything that turned up, to be invested for his own especial praise and glory in having done up his piety and humility, as he trusted, to the satisfaction of the parlour. He clapped his palm leaf on his head, with a sort of rakish, free and easy air, and proceeded to the dominions of Aunt Chloe, with the intention of flourishing largely in the kitchen. "I'll speechify these yer niggers," said Sam to himself. "Now I've got a chance. Lord, I'll reel it off to make 'em stare." It must be observed that one of Sam's special delights had been to ride in attendance on his master to all kinds of political gatherings, where, roosted on some rail fence or perched aloft in some tree, he would sit watching the orators with the greatest apparent gusto, and then descending among the various brethren of his own colour, assembled on the same errand, he would edify and delight them with the most ludicrous burlesques and imitations, all delivered with the most imperturbable earnestness and solemnity. And though the auditors immediately about him were generally of his own colour, if not infrequently happened, that they were fringed pretty deeply with those of a fairer complexion, who listened, laughing and winking, to Sam's great self-congratulation. In fact, Sam considered oratory as his vocation, and never let slip an opportunity of magnifying his office. Now, between Sam and Aunt Chloe there had existed from ancient times a sort of chronic feud, or rather a decided coolness. But as Sam was meditating, something in the provision department, as the necessary and obvious foundation of his operations, he determined on the present occasion to be eminently conciliatory, for he well knew that although Mrs. Orders would undoubtedly be followed to the letter, yet he should gain a considerable deal by enlisting the spirit also. He therefore appeared before Aunt Chloe with a touchingly subdued, resigned expression, like one who has suffered immeasurable hardships in behalf of a persecuted fellow creature, enlarged upon the fact that Mrs. had directed him to come to Aunt Chloe for whatever might be wanting to make up the balance in his solids and fluids, and thus unequivocally acknowledged her right and supremacy in the cooking department, and all thereto pertaining. The thing took accordingly. No poor, simple, virtuous body was ever cajoled by the attention of an electioneering politician with more ease than Aunt Chloe was won over by Master Sam's suavities.
and if he had been the prodigal son himself, he could not have been overwhelmed with more maternal bountifulness, and he soon found himself seated, happy and glorious, over a large tin pan, containing a sort of olla podrida of all that had appeared on the table for 2 or 3 days past. Savory morsels of ham, golden blocks of corn cake, fragments of pie, of every conceivable mathematical figure, chicken wings, gizzards, and drumsticks, all appeared in picturesque confusion, and Sam, as monarch of all he surveyed, sat with his palm leaf cocked rejoicingly to one side and patronizing Andy at his right hand. The kitchen was full of all his compeers, who had hurried and crowded in from the various cabins to hear the termination of the day's exploits. Now was Sam's hour of glory. The story of the day was rehearsed, with all kinds of ornament and varnishing, which might be necessary to heighten its effect. For Sam, like some of our fashionable dilettanti, never allowed a story to lose any of its gilding by passing through his hands. Roars of laughter attended the narration and were taken up and prolonged by all the smaller fry, who were lying in any quantity about on the floor or perched in every corner. In the height of the uproar and laughter, Sam, however, preserved an immovable gravity, only from time to time rolling his eyes up and giving his auditors diverse inexpressible droll glances, without departing from the sententious elevation of his oratory. "You see, fellow countrymen," said Sam, elevating a turkey's leg with energy, "you see now what this here child's up to, for fennin' y'all, yes, all on yer. For him as tries to get one of our people is as good as trying to get all. You see the principle in the same? That's our Claire. And any ones of these here drivers that come smellin' round, are there any our people? Why, he's got me in his way. I'm the feller he's got to set in with. I'm the feller for y'all to come to, brethren. I'll stand up for your rights. I'll fend them to the last breath." "Why, but Sam, you're telling me, only this morning, that you'd have helped this year master to catch Lizzie." "Seems to me your talk don't hang together," said Andy. "I tell you now, Andy," said Sam with awful superiority, "don't you be a-talkin' about what you don't know nothing on. Boys like you, Andy, means well, but they can't be expected to conclusiate the great principles of action." Andy looked rebuked, particularly by the hard word "collusiate," which most of the youngerly members of the company seemed to consider as a settler in the case, while Sam proceeded. "Daughter was conscience. Andy, when I thought of gwine out of Lizzie, I really expected Massa was sought that way. When I found Missus was sought to contrary, daughter was conscience, more yet cause fellers always get more by sticking to Missus' side. So you see, I's persistent either way, and sticks up to conscience, and holds on to principles. Yes, principles," said Sam, giving an enthusiastic toss to a chicken's neck. "What's principles good for, if we isn't persistent? I want to know. Thar, Andy, you may have died a bone, tan't picked quite clean." Sam's audience hanging on his words with open mouth, he could not but proceed. "Dis yer matter about persistence, fellow niggers," said Sam, with the air of one entering into an abstruse subject. "Dis yer's consistency is a thing that ain't seed and very clear by most anybody. Now, you see, when a feller stands up for a thing one day and not, de contrary to next, folks sees, and naturally enough to sees, why, he ain't persistent. Hand me dat a bit of corn cake, Andy. But let's look into it. I hope the gentlemen in their fair sex will excuse my using an ordinary sort of parison. Here, I'm a-tryin' to get top of de hay. Why, I puts up my ladder, dis yer side, tain't no go. Den, 'cause I don't try there no more, but puts my ladder right, de contrary side, ain't I persistent? I'm persistent to wantin' to get up whichever side my ladder is. Don't you see? All on yer?" "It's the only thing he ever was persistent in, Lord knows," muttered Aunt Chloe, who was getting rather restive, the merriment of the evening being to her somewhat after the scripture comparison like vinegar upon nitre. "Yes, indeed," says Sam, rising full of supper and glory for a closing effort. "Yes, my fellow citizens and ladies of the other sex in general, I has principles. I'm proud to own 'em. They's perquisite to these here times and to all times. I has principles, and I sticks to 'em like 40. Just anything that I thinks is principle, I goes into it. I wouldn't mind if they burnt me alive. I'd walk right up to the stake, I would, and say, 'Here I comes to shed my last blood for my principles, for my country, for the general interests of society.'" "Well," said Aunt Chloe, "one of your principles will have to be to get to bed sometime tonight, and not be keeping up everybody till morning. Now every one of you young'uns that don't want to be cracked had better be scase, mighty sudden. Niggers, all on you," waving his palm leaf with benignity. "I give you my blessing. Go to bed now, and be good boys." And with this pathetic benediction, the assembly dispersed. Chapter 9, in which it appears that a senator is but a man. The light of the cheerful fire shone on the rug and carpet of a cozy parlor, and glittered on the sides of the teacups and well-brightened teapot, as Senator Byrd was drawing off his boots, preparatory to inserting his feet in a pair of new handsome slippers, which his wife had been working for him while away on his senatorial tour. Mrs. Byrd, looking the very picture of delight, was superintending the arrangements of the table, ever and anon mingling admonitory remarks to a number of frolicsome juveniles, who were effervescing in all three modes of untold gamble and mischief that have astonished mothers ever since the flood. "Tom, let the doorknob alone. There's a man." "Mary! Mary, don't pull the cat's tail." "Oh, poor pussy." "Jim, you mustn't climb on that table. No, no." "You don't know, my dear, what a surprise it is to us all to see you here tonight," said she at last, when she found a space to say something to her husband. "Yes, yes, I thought I'd make a run down, spend the night, and have a little comfort at home. I'm tired to death, and my head aches." Mrs. Byrd cast a glance at a camphor bottle, which stood in the half-open closet, and appeared to meditate an approach to it, but her husband interposed. "No, no, Mary, no doctoring. A cup of your good hot tea and some of our good home living is what I want. It's a tiresome business, this legislating." And the senator smiled as if he rather liked the idea of considering himself a sacrifice to his country. "Well," said his wife, after the business of the tea-table was getting rather slack, "and what have they been doing in the Senate?" Now, it was a very unusual thing for gentle little Mrs. Byrd ever to trouble her head with what was going on in the House of the State, very wisely considering that she had enough to do to mind her own. Mr. Byrd, therefore, opened his eyes in surprise and said, "Not very much of importance." "Well, but is it true that they have been passing a law forbidding people to give meat and drink to those poor colored folks that come along? I heard they were talking of some such law. But I didn't think any Christian legislator would pass it." "Why, Mary, you are getting to be a politician all at once." "No, nonsense. I wouldn't give a fig for all your politics generally, but I think this is something downright cruel and unchristian. I hope, my dear, no such law has been passed." "There has been a law passed forbidding people to help off the slaves that come over from Kentucky, my dear. So much of that thing has been done by these reckless abolitionists that our brethren in Kentucky are very strongly excited, and it seems necessary, and no more than Christian in kind, that something should be done by our state to quiet the excitement. And what is the law? It don't forbid us to shelter those poor creatures at night, does it, and to give them something comfortable to eat, and a few old clothes, and send them quietly about their business?" "Why, yes, my dear, that would be aiding and abetting, you know." Mrs. Byrd was a timid, blushing little woman, of about 4 feet in height, and with mild blue eyes and a peach-blow complexion, and the gentlest, sweetest voice in the world. As for courage, a moderate-sized cock-turkey had been known to put her to rout at the very first gobble, and a stout house-dog of modest capacity would bring her into subjections merely by a show of his teeth. Her husband and children were her entire world, and in these she ruled more by entreaty and persuasion than by command or argument. There was only one thing that was capable of arousing her, and that provocation came in on the side of her unusual gentle and sympathetic nature. Anything in the shape of cruelty would throw her into a passion, which was the more alarming and inexplicable in proportion to the general softness of her nature. Generally, the most indulgent and easy to be entreated of all mothers, still her boys had a very reverent remembrance of a most vehement chastisement she had once bestowed on them, because she found them leagued with several graceless boys of the neighborhood, stoning a defenseless kitten. "I'll tell you what," Master Bill used to say, "I was scared that time. Mother came at me so that I thought she was crazy, and I was whipped and tumbled off to bed without any supper before I could get over wondering what had come about, and after that I heard Mother crying outside the door, which made me feel worse than all the rest." "I'll tell you what," he'd said, "we boys never stoned another kitten." On the present occasion, Mrs. Byrd rose quickly, with very red cheeks, which quite improved her general appearance, and walked up to her husband with quite a resolute air, and said in a determined tone, "Now, John, I want to know if you think such a law as that is right and Christian." "You won't shoot me now, Mary, if I say I do."
"I never could have thought it of you, John. You didn't vote for it."
"Even so, my fair politician."
"You ought to be ashamed, John. Poor, homeless, houseless creatures. It's a shameful, wicked, abominable law, and I'll break it, for one, the first time I get a chance, and I hope I shall have a chance. I do. Things have got to a pretty pass if a woman can't give a warm supper and a bed to poor, starving creatures, just because they are slaves, and have been abused and oppressed all their lives. Poor things."
"But, Mary, just listen to me. Your feelings are all quite right, dear, and interesting, and I love you for them, but then, dear, we mustn't suffer our feelings to run away with our judgment. You must consider. It's a matter of private feeling.
There are great public interests involved. There is such a state of public agitation rising that we must put aside our private feelings.
Now, John, I don't know anything about politics, but I can read my Bible. And there I see that I must feed the hungry, clothe the naked, and comfort the desolate. And that Bible I mean to follow.
But in cases where you're doing so would involve a great public evil.
Obeying God never brings on public evils. I know it can't. It's always safest all round to do as he bids us.
Now listen to me, Mary, and I can state to you a very clear argument to show.
Oh, nonsense, John. You can talk all night, but you wouldn't do it.
I put it to you, John, would you now turn away a poor, shivering, hungry creature from your door because he was a runaway? Would you now?
Now, if truth must be told, our senator had the misfortune to be a man who had a particularly humane and accessible nature, and turning away anybody that was in trouble never had been his forte. And what was worse for him in this particular pinch of the argument was that his wife knew it, and of course was making an assault on rather an indefensible point. So he had recourse to the usual means of gaining time for such cases made and provided, he said, ahem, and coughed several times, took out his pocket handkerchief, and began to wipe his glasses. Mrs. Bird, seeing the defenseless condition of the enemy's territory, had no more conscience than to push her advantage.
I should like to see you doing that, John. I really should. Turning a woman out of doors in a snowstorm, for instance, or maybe you'd take her up and put her in jail, wouldn't you?
You would make a great hand at that.
Of course, it would be a very painful duty, began Mr. Bird in a moderate tone.
Duty? John, don't use that word. You know it isn't a duty. It can't be a duty. If folks want to keep their slaves from running away, let 'em treat 'em well. That's my doctrine. If I had slaves, as I hope I never shall have, I'd risk their wanting to run away from me or you either, John. I tell you, folks don't run away when they are happy, and when they do run, poor creatures, they suffer enough with cold and hunger and fear, without everybody's turning against them. And law or no law, I never will, so help me God.
Mary, Mary, my dear, let me reason with you.
I hate reasoning, John, especially reasoning on such subjects. There's a way you political folks have of coming round and round a plain right thing, and you don't believe in it yourselves when it comes to practice. I know you well enough, John. You don't believe it's right any more than I do, and you wouldn't do it any sooner than I.
At this critical juncture, old Cujo, the black man of all work, put his head in at the door and wished Mrs. would come into the kitchen. And our senator, tolerably relieved, looked after his little wife with a whimsical mixture of amusement and vexation, and seating himself in the armchair began to read the papers. After a moment his wife's voice was heard at the door in a quick, earnest tone.
John, John, I do wish you'd come here a moment.
He laid down his paper and went into the kitchen, and started, quite amazed at the sight that presented itself. A young and slender woman, with garments torn and frozen, with one shoe gone and the stocking torn away from the cut and bleeding foot, was laid back in a deadly swoon upon two chairs. There was the impress of the despised race on her face, yet none could help feeling its mournful and pathetic beauty, while all its stony sharpness, its cold, fixed, deathly aspect struck a solemn chill over him. He drew his breath short and stood in silence. His wife and their only colored domestic, old Aunt Dinah, were busily engaged in restorative measures, while old Cujo had got the boy on his knee, and was busy pulling off his shoes and stockings and chafing his little cold feet.
"Sure now, if she ain't a sight to behold," said old Dinah, compassionately. "'Pears like 'twas the heat that made her faint. She was tolerable pert when she came in, and asked if she couldn't warm herself here a spell, and I was just a-asking her where she come from, and she fainted right down. Never done much hard work, guess, by the looks of her hands."
"Poor creature," said Mrs. Bird compassionately, as the woman slowly unclosed her large dark eyes and looked vacantly at her. Suddenly an expression of agony crossed her face, and she sprang up, saying, "Oh, my Harry! Have they got him?"
The boy at this jumped from Cujo's knee, and running to her side, put up his arms.
"Oh, he's here, he's here," she exclaimed. "Oh, ma'am," said she wildly to Mrs. Bird, "do protect us. Don't let them get him."
"Nobody shall hurt you here, poor woman," said Mrs. Bird encouragingly. "You are safe. Don't be afraid."
"God bless you," said the woman, covering her face and sobbing, while the little boy, seeing her crying, tried to get into her lap. With many gentle and womanly offices, which none knew better how to render than Mrs. Bird, the poor woman was in time rendered more calm. A temporary bed was provided for her on the settle, near the fire, and after a short time she fell into a heavy slumber with the child, who seemed no less weary, soundly asleep on her arm. For the mother resisted with nervous anxiety the kindest attempts to take him from her, and even in sleep her arm encircled him with an unrelaxing clasp, as if she could not even then be beguiled of her vigilant hold.
Mr. and Mrs. Bird had gone back to the parlour, where, strange as it may appear, no reference was made on either side to the preceding conversation. But Mrs. Bird busied herself with her knitting work, and Mr. Bird pretended to be reading the paper.
"I wonder who and what she is," said Mr. Bird at last, as he laid it down.
"When she wakes up and feels a little rested, we will see," said Mrs. Bird.
"I say, wife," said Mr. Bird, after musing in silence over his newspaper.
"Well, dear, she couldn't wear one of your gowns, could she, by any letting down or such matter? She seems to be rather larger than you are." A quite perceptible smile glimmered on Mrs. Bird's face as she answered, "We'll see." Another pause, and Mr. Bird again broke out. "I say, wife."
"Well, what now?"
"Why, there's that old bombazim cloak that you keep on purpose to put over me when I take my afternoon nap. You might as well give her that. She needs clothes."
At this instant Dinah looked in to say that the woman was awake and wanted to see Mrs. Mr. and Mrs. Bird went into the kitchen, followed by the two eldest boys, the smaller Fry having by this time been safely disposed of in bed. The woman was now sitting up on the settle by the fire. She was looking steadily into the blaze, with a calm, heartbroken expression, very different from her former agitated wildness.
"Did you want me?" said Mrs. Bird in gentle tones. "I hope you feel better now, poor woman."
A long-drawn, shivering sigh was the only answer, but she lifted her dark eyes and fixed them on her with such a forlorn and imploring expression that the tears came into the little woman's eyes.
"You needn't be afraid of anything. We are friends here, poor woman. Tell me where you came from, and what you want," said she.
"I came from Kentucky," said the woman.
"When?" said Mr. Bird, taking up the interrogatory.
"Tonight."
"How did you come?"
"I crossed on the ice."
"Crossed on the ice?" said everyone present.
"Yes," said the woman slowly, "I did. God helping me, I crossed on the ice, for they were behind me, right behind, and there was no other way."
"Oh, missus," said Cucho, "the ice is all in broken up blocks, a-swingin' and a-teeterin' up and down in the water."
"I know it was, I know it," said she wildly, "but I did it. I wouldn't have thought I could. I didn't think I should get over, but I didn't care. I could but die if I didn't. The Lord help me. Nobody knows how much the Lord can help 'em till they try," said the woman with a flashing eye.
"Were you a slave?" said Mr. Bird.
"Yes, sir. I belonged to a man in Kentucky."
"Was he unkind to you?"
"No, sir. He was a good master."
"And was your mistress unkind to you?"
"No, sir, no. My mistress was always good to me."
"What could induce you to leave a good home, then, and run away, and go through such dangers?"
The woman looked up at Mrs. Bird with a keen, scrutinizing glance, and it did not escape her that she was dressed in deep mourning. "Ma'am," she said suddenly, "have you ever lost a child?"
The question was unexpected, and it was thrust on a new wound, for it was only a month since a darling child of the family had been laid in the grave. Mr. Bird turned around and walked to the window, and Mrs. Bird burst into tears, but recovering her voice, she said, "Why do you ask that? I have lost a little one.
Then you will feel for me. I have lost two, one after another, left and buried there when I came away, and I had only this one left. I never slept a night without him. He was all I had. He was my comfort and pride, day and night, and ma'am, they were going to take him away from me, to sell him. Sell him down south, ma'am, to go all alone, a baby that had never been away from his mother in his life. I couldn't stand it, ma'am. I knew I never should be good for anything if they did, and when I knew the papers were signed and he was sold, I took him and came off in the night, and they chased me, the man that bought him and some of Master's folks, and they were coming down right behind me, and I heard 'em. I jumped right onto the ice, and how I got across, I don't know. But first I knew a man was helping me up the bank." The woman did not sob nor weep. She had gone to a place where tears are dry, but everyone around her was, in some way characteristic of themselves, showing signs of hearty sympathy. The two little boys, after a desperate rummaging in their pockets in search of those pocket-handkerchiefs which mothers know are never to be found there, had thrown themselves disconsolately into the skirts of their mother's gown, where they were sobbing and wiping their eyes and noses to their heart's content. Mrs. Bird had her face fairly hidden in her pocket-handkerchief, and old Dinah, with tears streaming down her black, honest face, was ejaculating, "Lord, have mercy on us," with all the fervor of a camp-meeting, while old Cujo, rubbing his eyes very hard with his cuffs and making a most uncommon variety of wry faces, occasionally responded in the same key, with great fervor. Our senator was a statesman, and of course could not be expected to cry,
like other mortals, and so he turned his back to the company and looked out of the window, and seemed particularly busy in clearing his throat and wiping his spectacle glasses, occasionally blowing his nose in a manner that was calculated to excite suspicion, had anyone been in a state to observe critically. "How came you to tell me you had a kind master?" he suddenly exclaimed, gulping down very resolutely some kind of rising in his throat, and turning suddenly round upon the woman. "Because he was a kind master, I'll say that of him anyway, and my mistress was kind. But they couldn't help themselves. They were owing money, and there was some way, I can't tell how, that a man had a hold on them, and they were obliged to give him his will. I listened and heard him telling mistress that, and she begging and pleading for me, and he told her he couldn't help himself, and that the papers were all drawn. And then it was I took him and left my home and came away. I knew it was no use of my trying to live, if they did it, for to peers like this child is all I have."
"Have you no husband?"
"Yes, but he belongs to another man. His master is real hard to him, and won't let him come to see me, hardly ever, and he's grown harder and harder upon us, and he threatens to sell him down south. It's like I'll never see him again."
The quiet tone in which the woman pronounced these words might have led a superficial observer to think that she was entirely apathetic, but there was a calm, settled depth of anguish in her large dark eye that spoke of something far otherwise.
"And where do you mean to go, my poor woman?" said Mrs. Bird.
"To Canada. If I only knew where that was. It is very far off, is Canada?" said she, looking up with a simple, confiding air to Mrs. Bird's face.
"Poor thing," said Mrs. Bird involuntarily.
"It's a very great way off, think," said the woman earnestly.
"Much further than you think, poor child," said Mrs. Bird. "But we will try to think what can be done for you. Here, Dinah, make her up a bed in your own room, close by the kitchen, and I'll think what to do for her in the morning. Meanwhile, never fear, poor woman. Put your trust in God. He will protect you."
Mrs. Bird and her husband re-entered the parlor. She sat down in her little rocking chair before the fire, swaying thoughtfully to and fro. Mr. Bird strode up and down the room, grumbling to himself.
"Fish! Pshaw! Confounded awkward business!" At length, striding up to his wife, he said, "I say, wife, shall have to get away from here this very night. That fellow will be down on the scent bright and early tomorrow morning. If 'twas only the woman, she could lie quiet till it was over. But that little chap can't be kept still by a troop of horse and foot. I'll warrant me, he'll bring it all out, popping his head out of some window or door. A pretty kettle of fish it would be for me, too, to be caught with them both here, just now. No, they'll have to be got off tonight."
"Tonight? How is it possible? Where to?" "Well, I know pretty well where to," said the senator, beginning to put on his boots with a reflective air, and stopping when his leg was half in. He embraced his knee with both hands, and seemed to go off in deep meditation. "It's a confounded, awkward, ugly business," said he, at last, beginning to tug at his bootstrap again. "And that's a fact." After one boot was fairly on, the senator sat with the other in his hand, profoundly studying the figure of the carpet. "It will have to be done, though, for aught I see. Hang it all." And he drew the other boot anxiously on and looked out of the window. Now little Mrs. Bird was a discreet woman, a woman who never in her life said, "I told you so." And on the present occasion, though pretty well aware of the shape her husband's meditations were taking, she very prudently forbore to meddle with them, only sat very quietly in her chair and looked quite ready to hear her liege lord's intentions, when he should think proper to utter them. "You see," he said, "there's my old client, Van Trump, has come over from Kentucky and set all his slaves free, and he has bought a place 7 miles up the creek here, back in the woods where nobody goes, unless they go on purpose, and it's a place that isn't found in a hurry. There she'd be safe enough, but the plague of the thing is nobody could drive a carriage there tonight but me." "Why not? Cujo is an excellent driver."
"Aye, aye, but here it is. The creek has to be crossed twice, and the second crossing is quite dangerous unless one knows it as I do. I have crossed it 100 times on horseback and know exactly the turns to take, and so you see there's no help for it. Cujo must put in the horses as quietly as may be, about 12 o'clock, and I'll take her over. And then, to give color to the matter, he must carry me on to the next tavern to take the stage for Columbus, that comes by about 3 or 4, and so it will look as if I had had the carriage only for that. I shall get into business bright and early in the morning, but I'm thinking I shall feel rather cheap there, after all that's been said and done. But hang it, I can't help it."
"Your heart is better than your head in this case, John," said the wife, laying her little white hand on his. "Could I ever have loved you, had I not known you better than you know yourself?" And the little woman looked so handsome, with the tears sparkling in her eyes, that the senator thought he must be a decidedly clever fellow to get such a pretty creature into such a passionate admiration of him. And so what could he do but walk off soberly to see about the carriage? At the door, however, he stopped a moment, and then coming back, he said with some hesitation, "Mary, I don't know how you'd feel about it, but there's that drawer full of things of poor little Henry's."
So saying, he turned quickly on his heel and shut the door after him. His wife opened the little bedroom door adjoining her room, and taking the candle set it down on top of the bureau, where, from a small recess, she took a key and put it thoughtfully in the lock of a drawer and made a sudden pause, while two boys who, boy-like, had followed close on her heels, stood looking with silent, significant glances at their mother. "And oh, mother," that reads this, "has there never been in your house a drawer or a closet, the opening of which has been to you like the opening again of a little grave? Ah, happy mother that you are, if it has not been so." Mrs. Bird slowly opened the drawer. There were little coats of many a form and pattern, piles of aprons, and rows of small stockings, and even a pair of little shoes, worn and rubbed at the toes, were peeping from the folds of a paper. There was a toy horse and wagon, a top, a ball, memorials gathered with many a tear and many a heartbreak. She sat down by the drawer, and leaning her head on her hands over it, wept till the tears fell through her fingers into the drawer. Then suddenly raising her head, she began, with nervous haste, selecting the plainest and most substantial articles, and gathering them into a bundle.
"Mama," said one of the boys, gently touching her arm, "you going to give away those things?"
"My dear boy," she said softly and earnestly, "if our dear, loving little Henry looks down from heaven, he would be glad to have us do this. I could not find it in my heart to give them away to any common person, to anybody that was happy, but I give them to a mother, more heartbroken and sorrowful than I am. And I hope God will send his blessings with them. There are in this world blessed souls whose sorrows all spring up into joys for others, whose earthly hopes, laid in the grave with many tears, are the seed from which spring healing flowers and balm for the desolate and the distressed. Among such was the delicate woman who sits there by the lamp, dropping slow tears, while she prepares the memorials of her own lost one for the outcast wanderer." After a while, Mrs. Bird opened a wardrobe, and taking from thence a plain, serviceable dress or two, she sat down busily to her work-table, and with needle, scissors, and thimble at hand, quietly commenced the letting-down process which her husband had recommended, and continued busily at it till the old clock in the corner struck 12, and she heard the low rattling of wheels at the door. "Mary," said her husband, coming in with his overcoat in his hand, "you must wake her up now. We must be off." Mrs. Bird hastily deposited the various articles she had collected in a small, plain trunk, and locking it, desired her husband to see it in the carriage, and then proceeded to call the woman. Soon arrayed in a cloak, bonnet, and shawl that had belonged to her benefactress, she appeared at the door with her child in her arms. Mr. Bird hurried her into the carriage, and Mrs. Bird pressed on after her to the carriage steps. Eliza leaned out of the carriage and put out her hand, a hand as soft and beautiful as was given in return. She fixed her large dark eyes full of earnest meaning on Mrs. Bird's face, and seemed going to speak. Her lips moved. She tried once or twice, but there was no sound, and pointing upward with a look never to be forgotten, she fell back in the seat and covered her face. The door was shut, and the carriage drove on. What a situation now for a patriotic senator that had been all the week before spurring up the legislature of his native state to pass more stringent resolutions against escaping fugitives, their harborers and abettors. Our good senator in his native state had not been exceeded by any of his brethren at Washington, in the sort of eloquence which has won for them immortal renown. How sublimely he had sat with his hands in his pockets and scouted all sentimental weakness of those who would put the welfare of a few miserable fugitives before great state interests. He was as bold as a lion about it, and mightily convinced not only himself, but everybody that heard him, that then his idea of a fugitive was only an idea of the letters that spell the word, or at the most the image of a little newspaper picture of a man with a stick and bundle, with runaway from the subscriber under it. The magic of the real presence of distress, the imploring human eye, the frail, trembling human hand, the despairing appeal of helpless agony, these he had never tried. He had never thought that a fugitive might be a hapless mother, a defenseless child, like that one which was now wearing his lost boy's little well-known cap. And so, as our poor senator was not stone or steel, as he was a man, and a downright noble-hearted one too, he was, as everybody must see, in a sad case for his patriotism, and you need not exult over him, good brother of the Southern States. For we have some inklings that many of you, under similar circumstances, would not do much better. We have reason to know in Kentucky, as in Mississippi, our noble and generous hearts, to whom never was tale of suffering told in vain. Ah, good brother, it is fair for you to expect of us services, which your own brave, honorable heart would not allow you to render, were you in our place. Be that as it may, if our good senator was a political sinner,
he was in a fair way to expiate it by his night's penance. There had been a long, continuous period of rainy weather, and the soft, rich earth of Ohio,